Police clash with protesters demanding the resignation of President Castillo, who is facing criminal investigations for corruption. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Badr Zanjefe. Good to have you with us. Now, Kiev accusing Moscow of using Iran-made drones in the war in Ukraine. Iran has rejected the allegation, blaming the West for preventing Ukraine from discussing the issue with Tehran.
We agreed with the foreign minister of Ukraine for them to provide us with any evidence that Russia has been using Iranian drones in Ukraine. We had an agreement with Ukraine 2 weeks ago to be held in a European nation. Our political delegation was sent to the country, but unfortunately, in the final moments, the Ukrainian side did not show up. The reason was the United States and some European nations, especially Germany, had told Ukraine you want to drink coffee with the Iranians in a European nation while we're trying to impose sanctions due to drones.
Amir Abdullah made a comment addressing reporters in the Iranian capital, Tehran. He rejected claims that his country has provided Moscow with missiles in the Ukraine conflict. Amir Abdullah, however, said that Tehran has provided Russia with a small number of drones, but that months prior to the war in Ukraine. The top diplomat noted that the Islamic Republic will not remain indifferent on the issue if it's proved to Tehran that Russia has used Iranian drones in the Ukraine war. The foreign minister's comments drew reaction from Ukraine, with President Zelensky accusing Tehran of lying.
The official Iranian representatives have released a statement today. They have decided to admit that they did supply drones for Russian terror, but they were lying in this recognition as well. We are shooting down at least 10 Iranian drones daily, while the Iranian regime claims that it allegedly provided few of them before the start of the full-scale invasion. Only during one day yesterday, 11 Shaheds were destroyed.
Zelensky accuses Iran of teaching the Russian military personnel how to use those drones, adding that Moscow pays Tehran for the cooperation. In recent weeks, Ukraine has reported a surge in drone attacks on civilian infrastructure, notably targeting power stations and dams, using Iranian-made drones. That's why Russia has denied its forces have used those drones to attack Ukraine. Iran has successfully tested the first stage of a homegrown satellite carrier running on solid fuel. The test was performed by IRGC's Aerospace Division. IM-100 suborbital three-stage solid-fuel space launcher is the first of its kind manufactured by IRGC scientists. The vehicle can carry satellites weighing 80 kilos into an orbit 500 kilometers above the Earth. IRGC authorities say that the carrier will be employed for the launch of a satellite called Nahid. The satellite is manufactured by the Iranian Minister of Information and Communications Technology. Israeli soldiers have killed another Palestinian man in the occupied West Bank. We were joined by our correspondent Mona Kandil in Ramallah a short time ago, and she provided us with some details regarding the latest regime's crimes.
Well, this night, an 18-year-old Palestinian was transferred to a Palestinian hospital after he was shot by Israeli forces when he arrived at the hospital. 18-year-old Mus'ab Nafel succumbed to his injuries. What happened this night is that Israeli military claimed that Palestinians were throwing stones at Israeli military vehicles on Route 16 near the Palestinian town of Sinjar near Ramallah. The Israeli forces opened fire at whom they describe as stone throwers. They killed this 18-year-old Palestinian and seriously wounded the other young man, and they took him with him. So they opened fire at a Palestinian. He was transferred to hospital and succumbed to injuries. The second one was seriously wounded but was arrested by the Israeli forces. We have to mention that many cases, Palestinians were killed in cold blood, and then the Israeli forces have said that those people who were killed had either attacked the Israelis, opened fire at them, tried to stab Israeli soldiers, and now they are saying that those Palestinians were throwing stones at Israeli military vehicles in the area of Sinjar.
U.S. President Joe Biden and his predecessors, Democrat Barack Obama and Republican Donald Trump, are sounding the alarm over threats to American democracy And that's while the countdown has started to the congressional midterm elections. The three-man converged on Pennsylvania on Saturday to push their parties to the finishing line. Biden said that race marks a defining moment for U.S. democracy. Obama echoed his warning, saying that the stakes are high as democracy is on the ballot. At the same time, Obama attacked Republicans are becoming increasingly averse to everything from signs to respect for rules. And Trump blamed Biden for turning the country into a police state. Americans will go on to the polls on Tuesday to decide who will control Congress during the final 2 years of Biden's first term. This as a vast majority of American people fear that the country will go through a period of political violence.
Shortly before their midterm legislative elections, a stunning new poll shows that 9 out of 10 Americans are afraid of politically motivated violence. The blame is apportioned in almost equal thirds. Democrats blame Republicans, Republican respondents hold Democrats responsible, and another third says both parties are equally responsible.
Neither party is actually putting forward any platform for actual unity across race, gender, class, etc., religion, and you know it's a necessary outcome of just the decades of politicization, and really the political moment that we're in right now, where you know there's a fascist movement in this country.
There have been 10 times the number of threats against members of Congress than there were just 5 years ago. The arrival of the corrosive Donald Trump and the seemingly equally corrosive repression of his supporters has revealed a national political culture plagued by self-righteousness, anger, and violence. An extensive recent survey found that nearly a third of Americans believe that political violence usually or always justified.
So I think the violence already is happening. I think it's a question of, you know, as we get closer to 2024, that violence is going to get turned up a dial. So I think it's really, it's sad, unfortunate, it's terrible, but I think it's a consequence of, you know, what the ruling class has actually, you know, fomented.
The poll was taken shortly after the in-home attack on the husband of the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. Many are shocked that the nation's vast and armed-to-the-teeth security services couldn't adequately protect the home of the nation's number three post. The incident continues to be the subject of salacious allegations, which have been exacerbated by the Pelosi's refusal to release their home security footage, as well as the refusal of local police to release their own body camera footage. The suppression of news reports on the incident has further inflamed public opinion. Polls repeatedly show that Nancy Pelosi has the lowest approval ratings of any prominent member of Congress. The Pelosis have been recently accused of insider trading, and the extremely wealthy family is often criticized for flaunting their affluence. Ramin Mazahari, Press TV, Chicago.
A U.S. media report has revealed that the Washington establishment and social media platforms are working together to censor what they refer to as online misinformation. Now, the report that's based on leaked documents from the Department of Homeland Security says the companies are working with the government to censor news on social media platforms that allegedly threaten U.S. interests. But the move has raised concerns among civil rights activists.
The United States is under fire for its efforts to influence cyberspace in the country. That's according to a controversial report by The Intercept, which is based on leaked internal memos, emails, and documents of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. The work is primarily done by Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, which is a DHS sub-agency tasked with protecting critical national infrastructure. The report says the U.S. government has pressured social media platforms to, quote, shape online discourse. The platforms include Twitter and Facebook. The department has justified this pressure on social media platforms by claiming that it wants to fight, quote, disinformation. The plan stemmed from concerns around alleged Russian influence in the 2016 presidential election. It also began to take shape during the 2020 election and over efforts to shape discussions around vaccine policy during the coronavirus pandemic. But how this information is defined by the government has not been clearly articulated. There are now concerns that the inherently subjective nature of what could be classified as disinformation will give officials in the Department of Homeland Security a broad opening to make politically motivated determinations about what constitutes dangerous speech. This is while critics say the extent to which the DHS initiatives affect Americans' daily social feeds is unclear.
We must rethink our approach to cybersecurity. Releasing alerts, deploying incident response teams, sharing best practices are important tools. But as the pace and scale of cyber threats that we face expands, so must our response toolkit. We need sustained investment to modernize and protect our most critical federal systems, as well as state and local governments, suffering under budget constraints and increasingly aggressive ransomware operators.
Based on the report, the U.S. government has used its power over social media to try to shape online discourse, but the extent to which the U.S. government has spied in the private domain of individuals has remained unknown to the American public. The government's spying activities on citizens of the U.S. and around the world first hit the headlines in 2013 when former National Security Agency employee Edward Snowden leaked classified intelligence documents.
The CISA's domain has gradually expanded to encompass more subjects it believes amount to critical infrastructure. Some believe CISA's goal is to make platforms more responsive to their demands. There are suggested platforms of all sizes, mainstream media, cable news, hyperpartisan media, talk radio, and other online resources. Critics say there is growing evidence that the legislative and executive branch officials are using social media companies to engage in censorship by surrogate. But the growing authoritarian acts by the DHS and the FBI to monitor Americans have raised alarm among civil rights activists. They say the authoritarian nature of such acts are contrary to the U.S. Privacy Act of 1974, which was legislated after the Watergate scandal that led to President Richard Nixon's resignation. The act prohibits state data collection of Americans exercising their First Amendment rights. Critics also say there are no specific legal constraints on the FBI's use of social media. The extent of U.S. spy agencies' control of the online activities of citizens in the U.S. and other countries first hit the headlines in 2013 when former U.S. National Security Agency employee Edward Snowden leaked classified intelligence documents on this issue. Recently, Snowden sounded the alarm again, warning that the U.S. was expanding its mass espionage activities both inside the U.S. and outside the country.
Moving on, scenes of violent scuffles in Peru capital Lima, where police have blocked anti-government rallyers trying to march on the presidential palace and the parliament. Mounted police used tear gas and charged a crowd to disperse them. Demonstrators demand the resignation of President Pedro Castillo. Similar events were held in other cities across the country. Lima has also witnessed rival rallies by Castillo supporters. The president, who took office in July 2021, is facing 6 criminal investigations for corruption. But it's not possible to prosecute him on criminal charges while he's in office. He's already survived 2 impeachment attempts. Castillo has been defying calls to step down, and he rejects all allegations of corruption. The UK is bracing for a fresh wave of strikes as nurses vote for the first national action over a pay dispute. More than 300,000 members of the Royal College of Nursing have taken part in the strike ballot, the biggest in the union's 106-year history. Reports show an experienced nurse's salary has fallen by 20% in real terms since 2010. The RCN says that the government is exploiting the goodwill and expertise of nursing staff. The industrial action is set to take place within a few weeks. It's likely to disrupt operations and appointments, even as patients are already facing record waiting lists. However, organizers say the action is the support of patients. The UK is struggling with a cost of living crisis. It's seen a wave of walkouts across various industries in recent months. Same with the UK. Public discontent with the government is lingering. Thousands from across the nation descended upon the capital, London, over the weekend to protest the country's worsening cost of living crisis and to demand a general election. Saeed Puraza has been to that protest and filed a report.
Unaffordable rents, choosing between meals and heating, and tears when the bills arrive. Some of the issues that have drawn thousands from across England to the capital on this rainy day.
Concerned about the future, they're protesting against what they see as years of government inaction has led to a deepening cost of living crisis, a squeeze on people's finances, and pushed public services to the brink.
Organized by the People's Assembly, they've named the demo Britain is Broken, a name that captures the country's multiple crises. The government blames the emergency at home on the crises abroad, such as the war in Ukraine and global energy price hikes. The protesters here say it's all the result of more than a decade of conservative rule and that the time for change has come. The mass demonstration comes only days after the Bank of England increased interest rates yet again to control double-digit inflation. The new Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, is announcing his economic plan later this month, expected to include increased taxes and cuts to public spending, meaning the outlook for ordinary Britons looks gloomier than it is now. Saeed Puraza, London.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Welcome back to Aperture. The illegal recycling of electronics is a toxic business on a global scale. Every year, three-quarters of electronic waste from Europe and the U.S. disappears from official recycling system and is shipped illegally to India, China, or Africa. In the first part of the documentary, we took you on an investigative journey through Africa, China, Europe, and the U.S. in an effort to unravel the out-of-control corrupt systems enabling illegal e-waste recycling. Stay with us as we further investigate to reveal the apparatus of large-scale trafficking, as well as a complex chain of responsibility and collusion in the next part of the program.
The U.S. is the only country in the world, apart from Haiti, that has not ratified the Basel Convention, the international agreement banning the export of toxic waste. To make matters worse, the U.S. government itself is as bad as anyone else when it comes to recycling its own discarded equipment.
The U.S. government is the single biggest producer of electronic waste on the planet.
Discarded electronics of whole departments are routinely put out to public auction instead of being sent to trustworthy recyclers.
Whoever gives the government the best rate, in other words, they can take it for free or almost for free, the government is kind of obliged to do that, because in our laws you're supposed to go the cheapest way to save the taxpayer money. But the cheapest way is the dirtiest way.
Recyclers who do actually recycle find themselves the target of shady exporters. Plant manager Craig Lorch has been in the business for more than 20 years.
We get regular requests from brokers that are in other countries looking to buy materials, buying computers, metals, laptops, anything with valuable materials in them. We don't sell to them. We don't know what they're going to do with the materials. We don't know where it's going to go.
Craig is part of a minority of conscientious recyclers who collaborate with Jim Puckett and the Basel Action Network. But many U.S. recyclers do export. The Basel Action Network estimates that between 20 and 50 e-waste containers leave U.S. harbors every day. To find out where exactly U.S. e-waste is exported to, Jim came up with a very effective spying technique.
We will just go around to these people calling themselves recyclers, and you drive by them, and the beauty is that you can't hide a big old 40-foot container. So it's very easy to photograph them, and they have prominent numbers, and we take pictures of those, and we date them.
Jim then goes online to find out where the e-waste containers are headed.
I can type that number into a database called TrackTrace, and here we see the whole record of that particular container in its last week's voyages. It's gone from Thailand to Singapore, now it's in New Zealand.
Analyzing the main trading routes for U.S. e-waste, Jim made a surprising discovery.
It comes through Hong Kong almost 65% of the time from the U.S. We didn't know that till we started tracking. Wow, they're all going to Hong Kong.
Hong Kong Harbor is the third largest port in the world, and any e-waste sent by the U.S. to Asia enters through here. But why isn't it seized and returned straight to sender? ...63,000 containers arrive here every single day on merchant ships of all shapes and sizes. Vincent Wong oversees the customs team at the harbor. The biggest terminal, Kwai Sing, receives nearly 50,000 containers a day. Up to 100 of them are estimated to contain e-waste. Tracking them down is a challenge.
Hong Kong is a free port. That means that the ship and the cargo don't have to declare to customs at the point of entry right away, except they are demanded by customs officers. They only need to declare after 14 days, within 14 days of the import or export of a consignment.
This means that by the time Wong and his colleagues receive the customs declaration, the cargo has usually long moved on. To combat this loophole, the customs inspectors pull out any containers which ring an alarm bell. For instance, because of the company's history or a tip-off from abroad, and submit them to an X-ray scan.
We can scan a container truck in less than 2 minutes, the whole truck, and then if necessary, we'll open the container for further inspection.
E-waste has its very own shape and look under an X-ray scanner. Items like computer monitors stand out clearly.
For e-waste, we have quite a number of cases in the past few years, and most of them are declared as plastic scrap or metal scrap.
Up to 36,000 e-waste containers are estimated to enter through Hong Kong Harbour every year, enough to fill 20 of the largest cargo ships. About 40 containers a year are intercepted, sent back, and their owners prosecuted.
We do not process each and every container coming or going out of Hong Kong. Around the world, there's no one custom administration that can process 100% of them.
As a result, there are always containers that escape the authorities. Chinese activists are trying to find out what happens to them.
I always want to do something to make some change. So I joined Greenpeace since 2002. The first campaign is working on the e-waste.
Lai Yun is investigating how the e-waste containers slipping through the controls at Hong Kong get to mainland China. Just north of Hong Kong Island in the New Territories, there is a perfect hiding place for e-waste in transit. Lai Yun has come to pick up the trail.
I heard about a lot of e-waste from the overseas, like the United States, coming to Hong Kong.
He soon finds a storage yard. The e-waste shipments await transport over the border. And since the storage of e-waste is not illegal, the authorities are turning a blind eye. There are dozens of yards in this area. The site contains everything from TV sets to monitors and computers. If these, as usually claimed on customs declarations, were really exported as usable second-hand goods, they wouldn't be sitting out in the open air in the rain.
I think that China and the United States, so important, work together to solve the e-waste problem. This is an international issue.
From the storage yards, the e-waste is smuggled across the border into mainland China. It's just a few miles away, but it's illegal.
The trucks reload in New Territories and drive across very close, and they have to pay a bribe. It's the only way they could get across. Or you use a small coaster boat and go up the Pearl River Delta into areas like Nanhai. And there, again, you'd pay a bribe to unload it.
Once the e-waste has crossed the border, it travels to places like the town of Guiyu.
When we went to the Guiyu, we don't see any signs to say, okay, this is Guiyu, but we just smell, very strong, the smell. Okay, we know, we arrived at Guiyu.
Guiyu is one of many Chinese towns and villages where illegal e-waste recycling is happening on an industrial scale. No. 80% of the population are involved, processing millions of tons of e-waste a year with the connivance of the industrialized nations. The owners of the yards buy the waste abroad for peanuts, then recycle it using cheap labor. No money is spent treating the toxic leftovers or protecting the workers, so an item can be recycled for a tenth of the cost charged in Europe or the US. As opposed to the African dump sites, in Guayu, there is a division of labor.
Very typical local family workshop. The workers also recycle the plastic or CRT. This guy used the light to burn the plastic and classify different types.
Separating different kinds of plastic by burning and smelling them is a cheap and effective technique, but it damages the lungs. Another family workshop specializes in recovering minute amounts of gold by dipping motherboards into acid baths. The workers are risking cancer by breathing in the toxic smoke. Afterwards, the remaining acid is simply dumped in the river. The groundwater has also been polluted, and even a simple cup of tea is laced with toxins. The constant exposure to substances such as PCBs, lead, and mercury is causing numerous health problems, including nerve and brain damage, skin diseases, and a rise in birth defects.
Really, what's happening is people are externalizing costs. You don't want to solve the problem, you'd rather let someone else deal with it, and you'll never have to pay for it. You don't ever get a bill from China saying, you contaminated my land, you have to pay.
China's factories in the neighboring provinces, for instance in Shanghai, Yangzhou, and Guangdong, immediately buy up any recycled materials, such as copper, aluminium, iron, gold, and plastics. But e-waste recycling is not only about selling scrap materials. An even more lucrative business is the recycling of computer chips. In clandestine workshops, transistors, integrated circuits, and other components are taken off discarded motherboards. The harvested parts are sorted and cleaned and sold as brand new components for the production of new electronics. This trade is said to be worth 100 billion euros a year, but it carries a huge risk that has an impact all over the globe, wherever computer chips are a part of our lives. For instance, in trains, planes, cars, nuclear power plants, hospitals, in short, everywhere. The companies who build the control systems for this kind of equipment are finding it increasingly difficult to distinguish between new chips and refurbished ones, and to be sure that their products on which many lives depend are safe. For TQ Systems in Germany, this is a daily challenge. Since the original label has been painted over, it's hard to know which type of chip it really is. Clues pointing to the origin of a chip on the scrap heap are broken and missing pins, or labeling that has been scratched off with a crude and blunt instrument. If the chips were sold as new, they should have come from a factory like this facility in Dresden, where new chips are produced in a highly controlled environment. But the scratched surfaces point to a different origin. Guayu, or another e-waste recycling village somewhere in the developing world. And this means that the chips might be damaged. Major chip manufacturers have started to employ investigators to keep tabs on the situation.
We're currently investigating a case where a customer had purchased from the open market a power module. They introduced them into a public transportation system, and after 1 month of usage, they exploded.
The module had burnt out inside. Stephen Jetta and his team found out that it had been fraudulently relabeled with a higher temperature resistance, probably because a higher resistance fetches a better price.
You can imagine if you have a power module that's originally developed in an environment where maximum voltage is 1200 voltage, and it's been remarked in 2400 voltage, it's not going to last.
TQ Systems have decided to check every single batch of chips on arrival using a special X-ray system. It will take time and effort to find out if the skewed connection is harmless or likely to cause a malfunction. Mike is back in Ghana and observing a steady stream of containers arriving from all over the world. Why do the Ghanaian authorities not seize the e-waste on arrival and only let in the functional second-hand goods? A young Ghanaian investigator, Anas Arameyo, has some answers. Anas always works undercover and has never shown his face in public. He recently took his hidden camera to Tema Harbor, Ghana's main port.
E-waste was one of the biggest areas that we looked into. For example, most fraud happened through the e-waste system. Customs have a form of valuation for such home appliances or goods, and the valuation is next to nothing. Somebody goes to clear used goods from the West, and they will look at it as condemned goods, so you are not going to pay the value that you would pay it ordinarily.
At Tema Harbor, no one is really interested in separating working goods from waste. Everything is declared as waste and let in virtually tax-free, with the help of a bribe, or a little present for the customs officers.
In many of my footage, you see the SEPS officers walking through the e-waste. First of all, they themselves start picking some that they think is useful.
Then the importers sell the material. The working items go to the second-hand market, the rest to the scrap dealers. For the buyers, it's a gamble, as up to 90% can be broken or in need of repairs.
There was nothing like anybody's going to check the efficacy. In fact, at the sales point, you are told that this is it. It may have a fault or not. For example, if you take about 30 of them, the ones that will be working well will be about 2 or 3. But then the people who buy also rely on doing some repair work on it.
The items that work or can be repaired go on sale in the streets of Accra.
Majority of Ghanaians, about 90% of Ghanaians, would want to depend on these second-hand equipment. So there are new phones, there are new laptops, but it is still expensive and people don't have the money to afford these things.
The second-hand market is thriving. A functional 10-year-old computer siphoned off the recycling system in Europe or the US trades for 25 euros upwards. But there is a big problem with imported second-hand equipment. Often it has only a very short lifespan left.
We should control not only the waste, but the near end of life equipment, so things that become waste really quickly.
Ghana doesn't have any recycling facilities, so any equipment coming into the country, be it e-waste to be scrapped, new electronics, or second-hand imports, sooner or later ends up on a dump site. Ironically, many of the old appliances will have been officially charged to the recycling system in Europe before being exported. But the ones doing the actual recycling work are a group of kids who eke out a living selling the small amounts of metal they can recover. This can hardly be called efficient recycling. All this raises a seemingly naive question. Given that when we buy a new computer in Europe, its recycling is included in the purchase price, shouldn't this money end up with the person doing the actual recycling, wherever they may be on the planet? If European e-waste continues to go abroad, shouldn't the European recycling system be extended and used to set up modern recycling plants in places like Ghana? Or what about a totally different approach? While harbor controls failed to prevent the e-waste from entering, while broken electronics are traded freely on the internet, while e-waste travels the seas by the container load, while Europe and the US won't stop the ships from leaving, while recycling facilities in Europe are leaking like sieves to shady brokers. We need to remember who is at the start of the e-waste chain. The consumer. Few of us can resist the latest gadgets, and we have gotten to the habit of constantly replacing them with the latest model after a very short time. Last year, worldwide, nearly 50 million flat panel TV sets were sold, 300 million PCs, and 2 billion mobiles and smartphones. Sales figures for consumer electronics are constantly on the rise, and not only in Europe, but also in emerging markets such as India, China, and Africa. Maybe it's time to redefine our roles as consumers and start using our gadgets for a longer time, before the entire planet is littered with discarded appliances that have a long and toxic life ahead of them as e-waste.
Perhaps it's important for the consumers to be aware of how overconsumption and subsequent illegal dumping causes suffering to other human beings across the globe. Perhaps this will lead to more responsible choices, but the bottom line is that governments in the EU and the US must take full responsibility by putting better regulations and systems in place. This toxic tide plaguing the world cannot be stopped while so many governments in the developed world are willing to turn a blind eye. And that's it for this week. Do join me again next time here on Aperture. Goodbye for now.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers, dear sisters, Salamun Alaikum. So welcome to this episode of Lantern from IRIB English Radio. On the continuation of this program, Lantern, we have an interesting story, and I invite you to listen to it. The title of today's story is The Magic of Thinking Big. Several years ago, I witnessed an exceptionally impressive sales meeting. The vice president in charge of marketing for this company was tremendously excited. He wanted to drive home a point. He had with him on the platform the leading representative in the organization, a very ordinary-looking fellow who earned the year just and the just a little under $60,000. The earnings of other representatives averaged $12,000. The executive challenged the group. Here is what he said. I want you to take a good look at Harry. Look at him. Now, what's Harry got that the rest of you haven't? Harry earned five times the average, but is Harry five times smarter? No, not according to our personnel tests. I checked. They show he's about average in that department. And did Harry work five times harder than you fellows? No, not according to the reports. He took more time off than most of you. Did Harry have a better territory? Again, I've got to say no. The counts averaged about the same. Did Harry have more education? Better health? Again, no, Harry's about as average as an average guy could be, except for one thing. The difference between Harry and the rest of you, said the vice president, the difference is that Harry thought five times bigger. Then the executive proceeded to show that success is determined not so much by the size of one's brain as it is by the size of one's thinking. This was an intriguing thought, and it stayed with me. The more I observe, the more people I talk with, the deeper I dug into what's really behind success, the clearer the answer. Case history after case history proved that the size of bank accounts, the size of happiness accounts, and the size of one's general satisfaction account are dependent on the size of one's thinking. There is magic in thinking big. We'll learn more about the story after a break.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear brothers and sisters, welcome to this another show of Lantern from IAB English Radio. In this show, we are going to talk about the difference between foresight and long dreams. Imam Ali alayhi salam says, أَلَّا وَإِنَّ مِنَ النَّعْمِ سَعَةَ الْمَالِ. Know that material openness is a kind of blessing. That is when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gives you a sort of material wealth, it is sort of blessing that comes to you from the side of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We know that whatever we have is from Allah, and we just own it, but we are not the real owner of that wealth or, let's say, capital that we have it. So Imam says that what this is a blessing of God. So in continuation of his speech or statement, Imam alayhi salam says, it is specified that the believer should divide his day and night into three parts: a time for praying and worshipping the Lord, and a time for providing the cost of living, and a time for focusing the soul to indulge in pleasures that are lawful and a source of beauty. So we see in an Islamic culture, in a religious culture, those who struggle in the field of life and economy are considered as those who are actually in the battlefield, those who are in war against the infidels. So we need how sacred actually Islam looks at the people who struggle to earn something. So it is not, it's not going to be seen as something which is a negative concept. So we see that foresight again and long wishes and long dreams are quite different. We have been talking about the long dreams and, let's say, long wishes. I want to refer to this concept from, I want to say that there are two different types of dreams, or let's say long dreams. You know, honest, positive and constructive wishes, the first group of dreams, the first group of long dreams and long wishes are honest, positive and constructive wishes that, like the water of life, make a person's existence watered and fruitful and increase the vitality and spirituality of a person. But the second type of the long dreams are the false and distant wishes. In other words, the length of hope, which is one of the most important moral vices and keeps people away from God and infects them with all kinds of sins, is this second type of wishes. So, of course, the principle of wish and hope, as I said earlier, is not only condemned and but also plays an important, or let's say very important, role in human life and progress in material and spiritual aspects. If the wishes are aimed at high human values and fine public and social aspects are placed on the path of real evolution and progress of humans and degrees of perfection. So what is better than that? And they make people to try harder in these ways. So such wishes are sacred wishes that they are highly praised and admired in Islamic and religious teachings. Basically, a person's effort is equal to his positive wishes. The wider their scope, the higher his effort. And even the vastness of the existence of a person actually is as big as his wishes. When this person actually wishes for the good and prosperity of the people, and actually the whole existence of his is to sacrifice on the way of God, it means that this existence is wide and high. The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
But there are some wishes and dreams, as the scholars of ethics say. There are when a person considers a very long life for himself in this world and believes that he has a very long life and willingly pays attention to all aspects and necessities of survival in this worldly world, such as collecting property, wealth, family, housing, and etc. In other words, long wishes here means many hopes in the world and expectations of survival in it. So this, as we said earlier and explained earlier, this is the one that is condemned to wrongfulness and is totally rejected in an Islamic environment. As we said earlier, so as we talked about, this kind of thought and effort is considered as a moral vice, because this kind of perception and understanding of the life of the world and love and interest in its functions, that is wealth and women and life and etc., has caused them to love and enjoy for a long time. And as the result will be the weight of separation and heartbreak from them. Long wishes make the human heart and mind forget to think about death and resurrection. This is what is quite commonly accepted by different scholars of ethics. A death that will cause a person to separate from these and everything that a person hates, he will move away from himself and try to distance himself from it. A person who was busy and entertained with empty dreams, he loved the world and its pleasures. He always wishes for something that is in accordance with his desire and his desire to survive in this world. Therefore, it is the fountainhead of long wishes and love for the world. Okay, dear brothers and sisters, I want to wrap it up here and end this show. And so what we want to conclude is that there is a principal difference between principal and basic difference between foresight and long wishes and long dreams. One is a sacred concept, and the other is a moral vice. Let's ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to help us to be attached to this foresight for the sake of Allah, to help his servants and to sacrifice whatever we have in our vision and imaginations purely with a pure intention for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala on the scene of the earth. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. أنا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The UN Climate Summit COP27 opens in Egypt with calls for action from wealthier nations to address the dire impacts of climate change. British nurses vote for the first time to strike over pay amid a wave of industrial actions gripping the UK in recent months.